The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this morning, can you hear okay? Everyone hears fine? Okay, so this morning I would like to go back to basics, one of the basic instructions, aspects of mindfulness practice, which is the practice of bringing attention to the feeling tone of our experience. The word is vedana, and it's an interesting word, vedana, because it's a closely connected to the word Veda, the ancient Vedic tradition, or to Vedanta, like the Vedanta tradition of Hinduism. They all kind of have one of the meanings, the root meaning is the word Ved, which is to know. But in Buddhism, at least, in Sanskrit, sometimes the word ved from vidyate also means to experience. And so it's a particular way of experiencing life, a particular way of knowing what's happening in the present moment that can be extremely helpful. So to get to that, I want to... So in the ancient world... both in India and in Greece around the same time, there were philosophers, if we can use that word, lovers of wisdom, who were trying to understand what makes up a wonderful life, a thriving life, a worthwhile life. And many people have done that, and in the religious world, it's not uncommon for people to answer that question with some kind of reference to the supernatural, some kind of reference to a deity or deities or to heavens or something. But for whatever reason, there was this period in the ancient time, both Greece and India, where there were people who were not answering that question of how do we have a successful or a wonderful life, in reference to gods or theology or heavens or hells, but rather in the directness of our life as it's lived here. And some of you know the Greek philosopher, I'm not sure how you pronounce it exactly, but I think Epicurus, who focused on this very much so, and he defined a happy life, a successful life, a good life, as a life which is without pain. And I think, you know, from that came the idea of being Epicurean, experiencing pleasure, savoring pleasure. And it might seem a little strange to many of us to think of that a good life is measured by the absence of pain and perhaps a pleasant of presence of a certain kind of pleasure. But there's a peace to be experienced, a sense of well-being to be experienced in the absence of conflict, stress, in the absence of pain, that some people find extremely meaningful. Meaningful enough that it kind of becomes their definition of a good life. The Buddha, in his time, was kind of, coming to somewhat the same conclusion. For the most part, early Buddhism was not looking towards a good life in terms of a future life, or rebirth in heavens or hells, or in reference to gods and deities. But rather, the good life is something that can be found here and now, in this lifetime, right here. And one of the ways, to attain that, to experience that, or the experience of that, of that good life, successful life, meaningful life, was most commonly described as a life of peace, to experience peace, profound peace. And so how is it we can experience a profound peace that's meaningful for us, that we really experience our life now as good, or that this is a wonderful way of living? And how is it that that experience of peace, is considered to be the highest kind of experience an individual can experience for him or herself? I think partly because if you don't resort to abstractions, if you don't resort to imagination, don't resort to abstract ideas or other people's authoritative claims about what's real, and don't look into the future lives for some kind of definition of a good life or meaningful direction, you're left with your direct experience here and now. And what is it about the direct experience here now? When is the direct experience of now provides a sense of completion or wholeness or profound peace? I think that sense of peace, the absence of conflict, the absence of strife, the absence of stress, can be very, very meaningful for people. So in Buddhism, that's the direction, that's the kind of goal, in a sense, is how to experience here and now a profoundly meaningful peace. In order to attain that peace, Buddhism says it helps if you use your attention. But to use your attention in particular ways. You don't just let your attention be just kind of, you pay attention kind of as you always pay attention. Because attention in Buddhism is not a neutral phenomena. We're not neutral attenders to our experience. But when we pay attention to our experience, we often pay attention to it through the filter of our conditioning, our values, our agendas, our desires, our aversions, our sense of self, our definitions of what it means to be a human being. And so it's often filtered through, for now we'll say, ideas, conditioning. And it's the unexamined way we pay attention is often a source or reason for why we suffer, why we end up in conflict or strife or living in fear. That, you know, it isn't so much that the world provides difficulties, but it's how we attend to the experiences of the world that has a lot to do with how much we suffer, how much we're in conflict or feel upset about things. And so Buddhism says that you need to learn to notice how you pay attention and learn how to pay attention in more useful ways or attend to our experience in new ways rather than just how we happen to kind of grow up to do it. And one of the ways that one of the teachings in time of from the Buddha was it can be helpful for this purpose of experiencing peace to notice that aspect of our experience where it's either pleasant or unpleasant. Now it can seem kind of reductionistic and simplistic to do that, and people can protest, say, "My life is much more sophisticated than that, and much more. You don't understand how complicated my issues are, and let me sit down and tell you." And this is not to dismiss the importance of attending to the complexity of life, but if what we want to do is not be entangled with the complexity of life, entangled with our experience of life, entangled with what's going on, we need to find some perspective that can help free us from that entanglement. Not to get disentangled so that we kind of just become aloof or distant, but perhaps disentangle so we're not suffering about it. And maybe if we're not suffering, if we're not entangled, we can see the situation more clearly. And so a big part of Buddhist spirituality is disentangling the tangles that we have. And to disentangle the tangles, it helps to know how to pay attention, what to pay attention to. And there's many ways to pay attention that are useful. And the Buddha said, basically, that one of those, of the many ways that are useful to pay attention, is to pay attention to whether your experience at this moment is pleasant or unpleasant. And it's rather vague in the suttas, in the teaching of Buddha, exactly what the formal definition of pleasant and unpleasant is. And I think that's the way it should be. Because it isn't a technical definition we want. We just want an operational definition of how we, as individuals, experience things as pleasant and unpleasant. I think most of us have that's a pretty basic, you know, duality that we many times experience. And it's good enough, the operational sense of how is it that we experience it right now, because it's based on how we experience pleasant and unpleasant, pleasure and pain, that is a basis for how we relate to that pleasure and pain. So it's not uncommon for people to experience things that are unpleasant and want to avoid it. The experience, it's relatively common people to have pleasure and want to have more of it. And again, one of the great kind of philosophers, if you may, lovers of wisdom or psychology or something, was Freud. And a big part of his teaching also was the pleasure principle. Was he pointed out how people pursue pleasure and avoid pain. And how there's sometimes a feedback mechanism, the pleasure principle, where we do behaviors, we do activities in order to stimulate the pleasure, the pleasure centers, and we are, you know, and sometimes that gets us into trouble. The opposite for Freud of the pleasure principle was, I think, called the reality principle. And for Freud, the reality principle had a lot to do with delayed gratification. And that as we grow up, we have to learn some degree of relating to pleasure and pain in a wise way, and not kind of going headlong into pleasure at every opportunity is a wise part of maturing. And you see that in young kids. There's up to a particular age, if you put a cookie in front of a kid and even tell them, you know, you'll get, you know, more cookies or something better in the future if you just don't eat that cookie right now. They've done these experiments and left kids alone in rooms. And up to a certain age, it's too tempting. The kids will go for that cookie. Though there was one remarkable kid in one study where they're watching them through the mirror, right? And one kid in early age understood somehow that he better off not eating the cookie. But it was very hard. So what he did was he crawled under the table and hid. I guess so he couldn't see the cookie or something, because he had to just grappling with his strong, maybe, desire. So some of us are grappling with strong desires, desires for pleasure and desires to avoid pain. And some people, haven't learned to go under the table yet, or haven't learned how to cope with it, haven't learned delayed gratification or avoidance of unhealthy pursuits, even as adults. And the humbling thing is that even a lot of people who think they haven't. It's quite humbling, I think, to start focusing on how our mind reacts to pleasure and pain, pleasant and unpleasant, to see actually how much of our reaction to life is based on this very simple amoeba-like avoidance of pain and approach to pleasure. We might think we're much more sophisticated, and we might think there's, you know, much more rationale and thinking behind it, but often it can be very that simple. That so much is based on that. And so because we get pushed around to some degree, or the mind kind of reacts so strongly to things that are unpleasant and pleasant, it often then colors our picture of what's happening. We don't see very clearly. And sometimes we end up doing things and acting in ways that are not healthy for us or helpful for us. And when we stay in a reactive mode to pleasure and pain, when we get kind of preoccupied with it and pushed around by it, the heart, the mind is not at peace. And so to start paying attention to the simplicity of, is this a pleasant experience right now or an unpleasant experience, can make our whole relationship to the present moment much simpler for the purposes of getting disentangled, if that's what you want. So you can be in a phenomenally difficult situation, you know, big social situation. It can be phenomenally complex. All the relatives are there, and all the history of all the relatives, and all the complexity that goes involved. And it can be very difficult and unpleasant what's going on. And you could spend a lot of time analyzing and strategizing and figuring out, you know, the details of all that complexity, which might be useful. But it's also possible sometimes to, in a sense, step back and recognize this is an unpleasant situation. I'm experiencing a lot of unease, a lot of unpleasantness in being in this situation. Now, given that it's unpleasant, can I find a different way of relating to the unpleasantness than the way I'm cringing or tightening up or pulling back or getting angry or something? Can I just bring my attention to just the sense of unpleasantness? And here is, we're using our attention in particular ways for the purposes of getting disentangled. And sometimes it's useful to just bring our attention to that aspect of the experience that's unpleasant. And some people will find if they do that, that there starts to be a little bit of distance from the experience, a little bit disentangling from that experience, and a little bit more sense of freedom in that moment. And that is, because it's so simple, pleasant and unpleasant, it doesn't kind of seduce us into spinning out in all our thoughts and ideas and feelings about the complexity of the situation. It kind of reduces it, in a sense, to something very simple. And some people find in that simplicity, they can breathe, they can just be mindful, they can get quiet, and just experience the unpleasantness. Now, maybe it's easy for me to say that, but for some people, it's a whole training to learn how to be present for something that's unpleasant without reacting to it, without automatically trying to push it away or trying to avoid it or do something else. Or it's a training to learn that you're better off facing the unpleasantness directly and feeling it directly. This is unpleasant. As opposed to ignoring it. One of the cliches or slogans in our scene is ignoring suffering is suffering. Ignoring suffering, when you are suffering, perpetuates the suffering, adds more suffering than needs to be there. It's kind of like another layer on top. And there's something, again, about how we use our attention, where we can bring our attention fully and completely to the experience of pain or unpleasantness, and there's less suffering in that. It might be counterintuitive because some people think that in that, you know, now I'm feeling it directly. It must be more. In some ways, it might be more acute because it's direct. But when we're suffering or when we're reacting and we're not really conscious of it fully, it's kind of operating in the background, there's a lot of unconscious or subconscious conditioning that comes into play of being for and against, of proliferation of thinking, of anxiety, of imagination, and all kinds of things going on that adds to the suffering. If we get simple and just be present for the unpleasantness and maybe feel the immediacy of it maybe more acutely, it more likely than not helps to begin put to rest all the associated ways in which we're reacting and that are kind of subconscious or in the background of the operating what's going on. So there's something about turning directly and experiencing this is just unpleasant and holding it in our awareness. I've done this with headaches. I've tried to ignore headaches or kind of just go along with life, something. And if the headache's kind of acute, I find it's actually better to turn my attention and feel the headache directly and completely. And if I do that completely and directly, then I don't proliferate my thinking. There's some way in the background of my thinking mind, I'm thinking, oh, this is terrible, and poor Gil, and how am I going to manage, this and that, and what are people going to think about me, whatever. But if I kind of take it in very directly, immediately, this is unpleasant, and stay with the unpleasantness, something around it can relax and settle. And in addition to this, the periphery kind of relaxing, peripheral reactions relaxing and settling, as we pay attention directly, there's something about the nature of awareness, that awareness tends to get broader and wider. It's kind of like we make space around the experience. And so both the periphery gets more settled, and the wonderful delight and pleasure of awareness becoming more expansive at the same time. What you pay attention to is important. If you pay attention to the quality of your awareness, and that again is a training to learn that awareness itself has a quality, and it's useful to pay attention to that. And one of the very great pleasant things to experience is an open, expansive, pleasant state of mind, of awareness. So what do we pay attention to? There's a infinite number of things you can pay attention to in the present moment. And you could just kind of randomly pay attention to whatever's going on, but it seems that what the Buddha was saying, there's a particular things which are more useful to pay attention to other things. and that one of the things is useful is a pleasant and unpleasant of experience. Now, as we pay attention to what's pleasant and unpleasant, that allows us also to evaluate, is this useful to pay attention to this pleasure? Is it useful to pursue this pleasure or not? Is it useful to stay present for this unpleasantness or is it not? Some things which are pleasant are useful to pursue. Some things which are pleasant are not. Some of us have had the experience of pursuing 5 minutes of great pleasure, wonderful, blissful pleasure, and then had months and years of suffering as a consequence. What was I thinking? You know, think of some of the things some of my pursuits as a teenager. So I guess I don't have to tell you, you can imagine. And I would have been better off, you know, seeing that this is temporary pleasure and just the pursuit of pleasure in and of itself. You know, there's other context, other situations setting into motion other things as well. And so maybe this pleasure, this pursuit is not worth the promise, the allure for it. Let's leave it alone. Other pleasures are very nourishing and meaningful. And sometimes even the pleasure of a sunset is useful to stop and pay attention to because it soothes the heart, the mind. If you're stressed and anxious, maybe it's good to be soothed and settled. Going into a peaceful environment, it can be very pleasant and enjoyable. Looking at art, talking with a friend, certain kind of sensual experiences. Meditation can be pleasant, many things. Sometimes it's healthy to pursue that because you can feel and see how it's settling and like nourishing. You feel like being fed. And this is good to be fed this way. There are certain kinds of unpleasant or painful situations that are useful to avoid. And certain kinds of unpleasant situations that are useful to bring our attention and to feel more fully in experience. And so can we just know the difference between it? Do we know when to pay attention to pleasure, when to avoid the pursuit of pleasure? Do we know when to pay attention to pain, and when to try to avoid the pain or not experience it or do something about it? So that evaluation, that wisdom, works a lot better if you, in a calm, relaxed way, bring your attention to the feeling tone of the experience. So you've learned how to bring your attention and feel, this is pleasant, this is unpleasant. Just feel it. As we train ourselves that way, one of the important things to learn is all the ways which we don't allow ourselves to feel the simplicity of this is pleasant, unpleasant. All the judgments, all the fears, all the beliefs, all the assumptions, all the emotions that come into play, they kind of cloud the view, cloud the vision of what's actually going on. And one of the very interesting questions to ask, is to try to imagine yourself in a situation where you have no access to any of your wisdom. And maybe you can imagine a situation when you're harried and upset and late for something and nothing's working and your mind's kind of crazy or something. And in that kind of state of mind, if you suddenly experience something unpleasant, what's your kind of unwise gut kind of instinct of how to react? And different people will react different ways in that kind of gut instinct, unwise way, depending maybe your personality, how you're wired. Some people will get angry at the at what's going on out there, at the experience, at the thing, or at some person who somehow must be responsible. Someone's responsible, it's not me. Some people get angry at themselves, and they get angry in many ways. They get angry, they feel shame, they feel upset, they feel discouraged, they feel like something's wrong with me. The fact that I'm experiencing pain or something unpleasant must be a sign of personal spiritual failure, because if I'm really a good spiritual person, I'm supposed to be floating on a cloud, just experiencing cosmic joy, And because I haven't, because I'm feeling some pain, it must mean I'm a Buddhist failure. So that kind of thinking just gets in the way. So to be able to weed out that and simplify it and just experience the discomfort, the pain in a very simple way. Just this. And there's peace to be found in just experiencing it like this. This is how it is. So an important part of the training is to begin understanding how is it that we tend, and when we're not wise, how do we react? So some people get angry. Some people, their instinct is to go to desire and pursue pleasure. If things are unpleasant, then let's replace it with pleasure. Now, it's okay. It can be okay to do that in and of itself. But we have a society that has plenty of examples of people who have done that move, replacing unpleasantness with pleasantness in a way that's caused a tremendous amount of harm. There's not a few people in our prisons who are there because of that, pursuing drugs, problems with alcohol. There's a whole society of addicts of all kinds in our society. We have, recovery programs for galore in our society. I mean, not just, AA, but NA, and is it SA, and sex addicts, kind of anonymous or something. And there's probably, I should be, there probably is like computer recovery. I mean, that's a quite intense pleasure principle operating there with computer games. And quite a few parents have come to me, parents of teenage children and young adults, and talk about how their teenage or young adults are staying up all night on their computer games. They can't get them off. Some of that just the pursuit of pleasure because it feels so good, and it's kind of addiction to feel good, not recognizing that in the bigger picture of our life, things are getting worse and worse. And sometimes it's a replacement, it's a reaction to feeling unpleasant, the pursuit of desire. Some people shut down when things are unpleasant. That's their gut reaction. They just kind of numb out or shut down, put their head in the sand like an ostrich or something, or pull in, become introverted, and they just kind of like it's hard to reach because they kind of like become so internal. So what is your way? The top three ways. It's useful to know that and see that, to get wise. It's sometimes hard to admit it, that, I have some unwise ways of... But to really see that everyone has a kind of basic instinct of how they would operate when their wisdom is not operating. To see that is very helpful because then you can see it coming or you can see it operating and say, oh, there it is. And then perhaps you don't have to get so entangled. You can step back and not be so involved in it. And then the question is, what's the opposite? When you are wise, say you're not harried and frantic, say you're calm, relaxed, you've had enough sleep, you don't have a lot of concerns. When you enter into a difficult situation, you can, you have a presence of mind to see what's going on. And so it's an unpleasant situation. How do you react then? What are some of the sources of wisdom and understanding you have to help you be wise about being present for unpleasant? So the same thing with pleasant situations. How do you tend to react to pleasant situations when you're not wise? And you see, it's a good thought experiment. I'd recommend it when you get home. Talk to a friend. And then what are some of the sources of wisdom and wise understanding you have for how to relate to pleasant situations, the variety of pleasant situations? Just the pleasantness of the situations, independent of the rest of what's going on in the situation. Now remember, the principle here is to use focusing on the pleasantness and unpleasant experience as a way of helping us become disentangled with it. Because entanglement is the opposite of peace. There's no peace in being entangled. And so to learn how to get disentangled, to be more peaceful. It can be very hard in certain situations to be convinced that it's worthwhile to disentangle and experience peace. Because sometimes we feel it's necessary to be entangled. We have sometimes strong beliefs that it's important to be disentangled. So one of the ways, so worrying, if I don't worry about the situation, then something will go wrong. If I don't worry about the situation, people will believe that I'm cold and aloof. People won't see that I love them. Some people are phenomenally loyal to their worrying because they think it's so important. And the worrying, because that loyalty to their worrying or loyalty to this particular entanglement, because it's familiar, even comforting sometimes, can make it very hard to feel it's worthwhile to step out of the disentanglement and experience peace. One of the fears some people have about disentanglement is if I'm not entangled, that peace will make me somehow neutral. That peace will make me somehow disconnected from the people, the experiences that are so important for me. And, you know, I would suggest maybe the opposite is the true, that the more you can experience peace, the more you experience disentanglement, that the more luminous or the more clear the communication, the contact, the connection can be. So how to convey the deep satisfaction of a peaceful heart and a peaceful mind, that it's worthwhile? I'm not sure how, but I think of it as kind of like the satisfaction of really clear water. If you see, look in water, and it's so pure, and you spend a long time sometimes looking into a clear lake and looking at the bottom. There's something quite beautiful about it. Or drinking really pure water that has no chlorine in it or anything. Yesterday I was driving around the Bay Area, and it was relatively smog-free. And I was in the East Bay and looking up in the hills, East Bay hills, and they were kind of golden and they're kind of yellowy or something. And they were really beautiful in that the clarity of seeing. So there's something about peace that has a lot to do with the absence of strife, the absence of entanglement, the absence of being caught. And in that absence, it has a clarity and a purity and a satisfaction and a joy and delight that is among the most meaningful that any person can experience. And it's the vehicle through which some of the best qualities of the human heart can come forth into the world. Love and compassion and generosity and ethics and things like that. And what Buddhism, I think one of the important aspects of Buddhism is in the example of the Buddha or other great practitioners, is how far it's possible to go to experience this peace and how meaningful it is. That it's possible to experience profound peace that frees us from entanglement with all the things of life so that no matter what happens to us in life, no matter how difficult the external circumstances of our life gets, in terms of, that we carry within us the peace, we carry within us this deep sense of well-being, that no matter what happens around us or with us, we're there and present in that well-being, here and now. Here and now is really the place where peace can be experienced. If we're thinking about the future, thinking about the past, it's too easy to not, too easy to lose touch with that wonderful, luminous peace that's available here. So that's my thoughts around Buddhist teachings on pleasantness and unpleasantness. So if any of you have any questions, I'd be very happy to take some questions. Okay? A little bit of where you came in pretty late, right? So I wonder, you know, but let's try. See what
I understood the idea of evaluating each situation, pleasant or unpleasant, and whether my reaction was wise or unwise. But the last comment you made about the idea that you could have sort of a reservoir of peace inside of yourself, do you mean, I understand sort of situationally adjusting, but do you mean you can actually hold that and not have to situationally adjust, that it becomes more of a steady state?
Yes. Yes.
How? I want that.
Yeah, well, you practice. Yes. So that's what Buddhism offers a lot of perspectives of how to do that, or a lot of approaches to that. So the teaching of today was one way to do that, which can seem very simple, it works for some people, is to start training yourself, being familiar, train yourself to notice how experience is either pleasant or unpleasant. And then what your relationship is to that pleasant and unpleasant. Because it's your relationship to it which is the key. What the experience is, that's where you have to have your street smarts and figure out what to do, you know, it's wise. But your relationship is your, you know, that's what you have the most responsibility for in terms of this path to peace. And so, practically take care of your life, for sure. But it's your relationship that's where the path is found. And so some people get blinded by what's happening in the world. So they don't actually pay attention to their relationship part, how they're relating. And when we sort through and understand in a very deep way and settle and help that inner heart, that inner space feel safe, that safety is found there, and to be nourished by that. One of the great forms of pleasure is a nourishment of deep inner safety and well-being. And then something can relax. And then as things relax, then there's a reservoir of peace waiting for you. Yeah, please.
So I related to the example of if you're around family and it's, you know, unpleasant situation. And so to step back and be able to reflect on whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, would you do that? Would you say, I'm going to go to the bathroom and do it for 5 minutes? Because I would have a hard time being able to recognize that and engage with everybody and be attentive and talking. And so when would you recommend being able to reflect on that?
Yeah. So, you know, it's nice to be able to do it in the moment as it's happening. It's possible sometimes to just kind of, in the present moment, kind of, you know, privately in your own mind, well, this is unpleasant, and breathe and open up and feel it and find certain balance by doing that and then staying in the situation. But if you're feeling overwhelmed, then it's not useful to be overwhelmed. The bathroom technique is great. Because, you know, most people are going to, you know, if you're going to say, I need to go meditate for 5 minutes, people are going to, what? This is an important meeting. If we're finally all together in one place, please stay. But if you say, you know, can I, you know, I need to go to the bathroom, most people will allow you to go. And most people are not going to ask you what you're going to do in the bathroom. That's a private thing, right? So, you know, you're going to sit on the toilet, maybe with a lid down, because you're going to sit and, you know, just check in and breathe. And it's a wise thing to do. And sometimes it's useful to take bigger breaks. You know, take a walk around the block. Sometimes I know people who've gone through intense family situations where they over many days, and they needed, you know, take an afternoon or even a whole day to be away, because it was just too difficult to stay in the fire all the time. Can you take it over here?
So I realize I'm the ostrich. But I think you answered half of my question. So I was trying to figure out, so let's say you're sitting on the toilet seat Like what, I think I'm able to get there, and I'm this ostrich, right? So what is going on in my mind? Like, how am I? Am I feeling the whole situation? Like, I'm trying to figure out how to disentangle. So, like, what is happening in my mind, or what am I trying to go
to? Yeah. So there's, you know, I can answer your question in different ways. So I'll do, this is one way here now. Say you've made it to the toilet. And it, you know, the bathroom is a good place for an ostrich, right? You've kind of escaped. You've done managed. So that's good. So then, so I would start to kind of try to first take a bird's eye view of the whole situation as wide as you can, and so just kind of the overall general kind of sense of how it is, and then begin kind of looking a little bit more closely. And so you might look a little bit at what are the thoughts that are going on for you. And then what are the emotions going on for you? And kind of work your way in until you're close into your body, and then what's happening in my body in relationship to all this? And feel the tension, the tightness, the energies in your body. And I find that one of the most useful things to do is to do mindfulness of the body and just hold in my awareness, in my attention, how the body is experiencing it all. Because the reactive mind, when we get caught up and reactive and entangled, it often gets expressed or has an effect on our physical body. And a shortcut way of kind of finding some peaceful place or resolving it or dissolving some of the tension is not to problem solve, but rather to begin to relax the tensions in your body. And as the body tends to relax and get, then it becomes easier to deal with the mental aspects of it. And so I would sit there in the toilet, and this is, you know, and just feel the shoulders, feel the jaws, feel the stomach. And if it's easy to relax, relax. But if it's not easy, just hold it. And an image that I like is to kind of, like you'd hold something very gently in your open palms of your hands. You let awareness be soft, open palms. It comes from underneath the tension or the energy that's coursing through you, and just hold it and be there as if it's okay for it to be there, and just let it kind of just feel like you're present and see what happens, and chances are it'll begin slowly to soften. And if it doesn't soften fast enough in your 5 minutes in the toilet, then it's very valuable just to know that it's there and to know that you're tense. And then when you go back into the difficult situation, you carry with you the knowledge, you know, I'm really tense. I think I have to be a little bit more careful what I say. I think I'll be slower to speak what I want to say. Yes?
Is the red light on or off?
It should be a green light.
It should be green. Hold it. I've noticed recently that...
No, is it green? The green light? I think you hold it in the button until it turns green.
It's either red or amber.
Oh, maybe.
Red.
It's
try
caution.
Try red.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. I've noticed recently that I use the thought of impermanence when I'm having a bad experience or emotional experience. If I click into this is impermanent, it frees me to then deal with the situation or the emotion with some spaciousness.
Beautiful, yes. Yeah. I've had that experience. I had done that as well. Because sometimes my mind falls into the delusion of permanence. I know better. I know it's not going to... I know logically it's not going to last forever. But my mind functions as if, uh-oh, this is it. I'm going to be this way forever. This is how it is now. But tomorrow, next month, next year, it's going to be quite different. Is very helpful.
Gil, I have previously heard this teaching with the categorizations being pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral.
Right.
I noticed that you didn't include neutral today. Is there a reason for that?
Well, it just, you know, it was complicated enough to talk. And they say that it's you know, and it seems that in the kind of Buddhist psychology, they claim that the neutral, or they don't use the word neutral, they say neither pleasant or unpleasant, is actually quite rare. But operationally, how, you know, we often have it much more often, you know, than, you know, often enough. And it's interesting to also look how we relate to so-called neutral. Or so, for example, it's very sad, and probably some of us had the experience of maybe being in the wrong end of this. Maybe it's all at the wrong end. But some people get energized when you're being praised, or and you get energized if you're being criticized. If your status or well-being somehow is either threatened or supported, it's, you know, you're alert. But if you're with someone who doesn't do anything for you, there's no benefit for you personally from being with them, then it's a new, you know, it's neither pleasant or unpleasant, and so people can turn off, you know, to be dismissive of the neutral people. Or same thing with experiences. You know, either it's pleasant or unpleasant, we're motivated. For some people, pleasantness and unpleasantness is the caffeine of the soul. And that's what keeps them going, and, you know, they feel like they're... But when things are neither unpleasant or unpleasant, and then they fall asleep, they get dull, they get discouraged. It's for sometimes, I think, the neutral experiences are experienced as being more unpleasant than unpleasant. Because it's frightening, it's disturbing, it's disorienting. You don't know what to do if you're always focused on pleasant and unpleasant. So it's an important thing to look at, and so I appreciate you brought it up.
Related to that, I was wondering, as you develop this reservoir of peace, do your reactions to the pleasant and unpleasant tend towards, do they start to appear more neutral?
Well, neutral, I think, is a dangerous word to use, because I think people sometimes refer to neutral as being kind of cold or disinterested or indifferent or something. As we get wiser and more capable in this world, our reactions to pleasant and unpleasant tends to be freer. There's more freedom or independence in relationship to them. And there's two ways that can happen, a variety of ways. One way is that we still might have reactions for or against it that are not so wise, you know, just reactive mode. But we can see it much more clearly, and we don't buy into it. And so, you know, you might want to push something away or push a person away who's unpleasant, but you see that tendency and you say, you know, I don't have to give into that. I have enough presence of mind to just see that and just let it go or operate in a different way. And then certain things, certain reactions that we have, we become free of them in the sense that we don't react that way anymore. We can see we see something that in the past we were addicted to, and there's no movement towards it or no movement away from it. You're just there and you're free. And when you're free, then you're free to respond in a way that's wise or respond in ways that's compassionate or helpful. And so there's still a response. But you know, there's much more choice. Over here. Oh, this will be the last one.
So I'm practicing what you just said, and I have a question. So I was thinking, I want to ask something, and I had a reaction in my body. My heart was beating fast, and I'm like, unpleasant, unpleasant, unpleasant. And as I was feeling my body more and more, and my bones and my blood and my heart, I was getting more anxious about it.
Oh.
So I went into my thoughts, and then I thought, no identity needed. No identity needed, nothing to prove, no identity needed. I came back to my heart. I breathed slower. Mm-hmm. And then it was shifting from, you know, I'm still a little shaky, but, you know, it's shifting to pleasantness. I feel traces of peace.
Good.
So my question is, you said going into the body and feel your body. And I also noticed that for me to feeling the body and then noticing what I'm thinking and seeing what other ways of thinking would be more useful, then assist me in going back to awareness of the body and
beautiful
feeling peace. Is that okay? So beautiful. Okay, so you just answered my question.
I think that so it was a beautiful example of how you used attention to notice what was going on, mm-hmm. and you found that by feeling your anxiety in your body made you more anxious, mm-hmm. and so seeing that you realized that continuing on that track was not going to be useful for you, and so you chose to pay attention to something else that brought you helped settle you. So that worked for you. In another situation, it might work differently for you, or for another person, their whole situation might work differently. Where for them, feeling the anxiety in the body, that's what settles them. So it's very important not to have a pre-established formula of practice. This is how it's supposed to be. But we learn from what happens. We learn from how it works for us. And then we kind of adjust and find the way that's helpful for us. And so you did a beautiful job.
Thank you.
Okay, so I hope it hasn't been too unpleasant. And thank you very much.